to welcome with us students from Judah High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is called Court with Class. It is a national award-winning program. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're provided briefs in the case, and many schools do extra work on the particular case. And also as part of the program, the students meet with a justice after the second case of the morning. And we're therefore delighted to welcome the high school students we have with us today. Now let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you're going to meet this noon. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Patience Rowensack.
Not here.
Who is not sitting. That's why there's the empty chair. All right. With those introductions made, I'll now call the case 03-1528, Stephen Thomas versus Clinton L. Is it Mallett or Mallet? Mallett. Arguing on behalf of Stephen Thomas is Peter Earle. He will get 20 minutes. There will be 5 minutes by Robert McConnell, who will be admitted pro hoc vici on introduction of Attorney Earle. There will be 20 minutes by Bruce Kelly, who will be introduced by Wisconsin Attorney Peterson, asking for pro hoc vici status. 10 minutes by Charles Muhlenberg, who is also going to be given pro hoc vici status, introduced by Attorney Daly, and then you have 5 minutes of rebuttal, Mr. Earle. Okay? Line up, correct? All right, we'll proceed. 20 minutes, Attorney Earle.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Peter Earle, and today I speak on behalf of the plaintiff, Stephen Thomas, the petitioner, Stephen Thomas. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce my out-of-state colleague, Robert McConnell, from the Providence, Rhode Island office of the law firm of Motley Rice, who will join me this morning in argument on behalf of the plaintiff. He has been admitted pro hoc vici at the trial court level and will be addressing the issue of conspiracy as it applies to this case during the last 5 minutes of our principal presentation.
My assumption is he's in good standing in Rhode Island.
Yes, Your Honor. He is in good standing in Rhode Island and has participated in proceedings below at the trial court level as well as before the Court of Appeals, and joining me in the briefs.
Thank you.
Okay. And I will discuss the issues related to Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution of the State of Wisconsin and issues related to the factual similarity of lead poisoning to DES. Mr. McConnell will discuss, as I indicated, conspiracy. And childhood lead poisoning is truly a problem of epidemic proportions in Wisconsin. In Milwaukee, the problem is nearly five times the national average. Thousands of little children are poisoned every day and continue to be poisoned throughout this country. I believe that I can say with near empirical certainty that as I speak to your honors at this very moment, somewhere in the inner city of Milwaukee, there is a child ingesting white lead carbonate manufactured by one of these respondents.
How is that going to stop the continuing problem if you win?
If we win, the industry will be held accountable for the harm that they have caused. If they are held accountable for the harm they have caused, they may step up to the plate and at least remedy the harms that they've done to children already and take some responsibility for the future. This is an industry that has done nothing to acknowledge or remediate the existence of the problem they've created.
But do they still manufacture this product?
No. No, Your Honor. They do not. It is illegal to sell lead paint for home.
They stopped that in 1978?
Yes. Some of them stopped before that. They stopped at various points in time.
I found it interesting that there's an amicus brief here from the Gonzalez Law Firm for the African-American Chamber of Commerce and the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And they say that expansion of Collins versus E.I. Lilly, may result in a redistribution of money from one entity or person to another. It will have adverse effects on the minority community, which you're talking about. And I won't read the whole thing, but they say the lawyers will certainly be enriched. However, expansion of Collins will never provide a true remedy. And the argument they make in that amicus brief is basically that you should look to the landlords, as in our Anawan case, I think, perhaps I won't say peace, but that was another case that this court had. How do you respond to that? That the primary responsibility should be on the landlords that have the paint is there, it's been there. We're talking about paint that went on in the 1900s or 1905. There's been a substantial consolidation in the industry, and you want to hold the under a collective theory, the producers, or I might say the manufacturers, liable.
Yes, Your Honor. Justice Wilcox, landlords are responsible for the maintenance of property. If they negligently maintain a property, they are liable for that. But they are subsequent tortfeasors. The deterioration of lead paint in housing is something that was anticipated, was foreseen by these defendants. Basic products liability law says that a manufacturer must anticipate the probable use and misuse, foreseeable misuse of a product. Here, the product was foreseen as something that would, and I would even back up a little bit further, because there is the question of the subsequent tortfeasor and their act of negligence, analogous, I would say, to the crashworthiness cases, where you have a negligently manufactured car seat and then a negligent driver causing an injury. The fact that there was a negligent subsequent driver does not ameliorate or do away with the liability of the underlying manufacturer for product liability and negligence in designing that product. But that's one set of facts. But we really have two sets of facts here. We have a situation where there also is, without regard to negligence, without regard to the negligence of the landlords, there is the production of a hazard. When painted surfaces, painted with lead, naturally abrade, when used as intended by the manufacturer and anticipated by the manufacturer, those abraded surfaces produce lead dust. Windows open and close, doors open and shut. That produces lead dust in the house. And that dust contaminates the house and poisons children. That dust is explicitly excluded from insurance coverage by the pollution exclusion and the lead exclusion. There is no remedy for the landlord against that kind of a circumstance. So we really have a situation where there are two types of injuries falling upon Stephen Thomas and other children like him. There is the lead contamination, the lead poisoning that comes when the negligent landlord subsequently acts foreseeably and releases the toxic substance by failing to maintain the property, foreseeable circumstance, for which they are liable, we contend. And there's the circumstance where the product itself, by its natural deterioration, without intervention by the landlord, without regard to maintenance, produces lead poisoning circumstances for children. And Stephen alleged both.
Mr. Earl, does the dust that you speak of only affect children?
It is most toxic for children under 6 years of age. Lead is toxic and bad for everybody, every living organism. But in children under 6 years of age, what it does is it interrupts the development, the hardwiring, if you will, of their neuropsychological system, their ability to have executive function, the ability to focus in school. It reduces their cognitive abilities. And what's particularly poignant about this circumstance, Justice Prosser, is that these defendants foresaw that there would be a disproportionate impact in inner-city urban areas where deterioration is an issue. In 1955, the Lead Industries Association referred to this, quote, as a slum problem, unquote. They knew that kids in the city, where housing maintenance is a problem, would be exposed to this on an ongoing basis. And what's particularly poignant about the circumstance is that the poison attacks the very ability of those children to overcome the burdens that are incumbent on the place they were born, in a situation of social disadvantagement. Poor housing, poor schools, deteriorated neighborhoods, inadequate health care. Those are burdens that befell Stephen Thomas by accident of birth.
Has any other jurisdiction extended this theory of collective liability to manufacturers or producers of the white lead carbonate? Because that seems to be the thrust of your argument.
And the answer to that question, Justice Wilcox, is no, because no other jurisdiction has adopted risk contribution in a context beyond and that foresaw going beyond DES.
Well, how do you get around the requirements of the Collins case? I'm talking about there, and I'm just thinking there we're talking about people that manufactured a product that were used by women that was adverse to their health during the 9 months that they were pregnant. Here we're looking at a product. If I look at it, this product was manufactured, white lead carbonate has been manufactured for, let's say, 100 years. In other words, when I read the appendix, I'll acknowledge that at least I read a very substantial appendix, looking at the argument that you made, it seemed to me that you're talking about a product that is manufactured. Like, for example, my question is, I fish, and I don't want to say I'm a fly fisherman, but occasionally I use lead sinkers. I'm just thinking about this. As a young person growing up in central Wisconsin and Wild Rose on the trout streams, we had a lot of lead sinkers, and they had a little clasp on them that you would have to close. I could never close it with my fingers. Right. I bit down on it with my teeth. Now, that was lead in its purest form, perhaps not white lead carbonate. Now, why not extend it to how? When you manufacture paint, isn't there an assumption that someone is going to be eating the paint?
Well, there's a number of layers to the
problem. Between that and gasoline or some other product?
Yeah, I will attempt to address the various issues you've raised because there are various levels of issues there. First, right, the question of whether or not a 9-month window of time for a pregnant mom taking DES is somehow factually distinct in a way that matters here to the production of lead pigment over the course of almost 8 decades is not a question of whether risk contribution theory should apply. It's a question comparing the magnitude of the torts. Okay? This is a tort that ran from the turn of the century all the way through 1978. The magnitude of the tort is what distinguishes it and should not excuse its application from a doctrine designed to address it. Right? That's my response to the question regarding the 9-month pregnancy. Okay? Lead, the defendants will surely argue, is ubiquitous. That there's lead in sinkers, there's lead in ceramics, there's lead in pottery. Our legislature has determined that the principal cause of lead poisoning is paint, deteriorating paint. And the experts will chime in and say it's around windows and abrading surfaces in the wells where that paint forms. That's why they want dust wipes taken to measure the content of lead in those windows. And in inner city housing, little children stand at those windowsills because there's no air conditioning at mouth level and absorb that lead that's produced by those windows opening and closing. There is literature with regards to lead in ceramics causing problems in some areas, but it's nowhere near on the scale we're talking about here. And I can make a comparison for Your Honor's sake, with regards to, for example, DEF. Similar arguments could be made and have been made by us in our reply brief with regards to DES. DES was very widely used as a growth promotant in livestock. And cattle and chickens, you know, had DES in their feed. They ate it. And people who ate meat during this period of time, and during, in particular during the period of time that Therese Collins was in utero in her mom's stomach, it was in the meat. And the federal government was trying to ban it. I mean, this DES, the same arguments of alternate sources applies to DES as it does to lead. But the difference is, this is the difference, the key difference, and this is that lead is such that if eaten in sufficient quantity, it will poison a child every time. There is no safe consumption of lead. DES, by contrast, when the mother took it during pregnancy, only caused a latent injury in a very infinitesimally small, I think it's 0.01% of the cases in which the mother consumed DES during pregnancy resulted in a later onset of adenocarcinoma in the child many years later. So the incidence difference is huge. There is a direct, and the manufacturers of DES didn't anticipate that little girls born 20 years later would develop adenocarcinoma. These defendants did. They anticipated. They knew there was a risk at the time that they manufactured the substance.
Mr. Earle, let me interrupt you for a minute. You told us you were going to talk to us about Article 1, Section 9. I haven't heard much about it. And that's an area that has, as my colleagues know, always fascinated me. My concern is this, in regard to Article 1, Section 9, and Justice Wilcox referred to this earlier. You've had a recovery here, as I understand it, from the landlords. That gave you a remedy, if you will. Why is that not sufficient under Article 1, Section 9?
The reason is that Article 1, Section 9 means what it says. It says that a person is entitled to a certain remedy for all wrongs and all, doesn't use the word and, but I'm using the word and, all wrongs and all injuries. Well, you know, conformably with the law. We don't dispute the defendant's proposition that we must take the law as we find it, as it already exists today. We submit that Collins is the law, that Collins is a modification of the common law by this court in response to a new circumstances that was done in conformance with the court's power to modify and adapt the common law to new circumstances. And it did so for negligence, and it did so for strict product liability. So that's the conformably to the law part. The word or is disjunctive, and it can't be interpreted any other way. This court in the past has indicated that it's injunctive. I think the case of Hull, in which the court uses the word disjunctive in a connection with the word or. The word all means all. The case of recently, I think it was last year, this court, Circuit Court versus of Dane County, State versus Circuit Court of Dane County, affirmed its commitment to the plain meaning rule after a very careful review of the history of that rule. These are certain words. They're not subject to technicalities. They're not a lexicon of a specialized body. These are words that have plain meaning, and that plain meaning should apply. So,
except for the Collins case, haven't we generally restricted Article 1, Section 9 and tied it into something else? For instance, I'm just thinking about a dissent that some of us were involved in last term, mm-hmm. where we tied it into other provisions, not just relying on Article 1, Section 9, but, for instance, tied into due process. Isn't that generally the way this Court has acted in regard to Article 1, Section 9?
That's true. I think one of the amicus point out accurately
what civil trial lawyers of Wisconsin point out accurately, that most of the cases dealing with the provision involve the power of the legislature and whether or not that article restrains that in some fashion, mostly with regards to statutes of repose. This Court, in Collins, acted a little bit more broadly, pursuant to the mandate it cited in the Bielski case, that it could reform the common law to meet new circumstances. But the point here is that in Collins, the Court acted. It's a fait accompli. It's precedent. It creates the it is now subject to the doctrine of stare decisis. That is the common law as we find it today. That is the common law that Stephen Thomas finds. And that is what Stephen Thomas is looking for, a remedy for a very fundamental wrong committed by very Chief Justice.
You're done. I am, sir.
Yeah.
You want anything?
I'm fine.
Let's suppose you could prove that during the 6 years that this child lived in these two houses, that all the paint in those two houses included the ingredient manufactured by one of these defendants. And I'll just pick one, but it's first, American cyanide. Okay? If you could prove that, then would we be here on summary judgment, or would we have a trial that you would have to prove that this component manufactured by this company was a cause of your client's injury, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the only reason we're here today is because you can't prove which of the defendants manufactured this particular lead.
That's correct, Your Honor. And for the very same reasons that the plaintiff and Collins couldn't identify the particular manufacturer.
So your position really doesn't need Article 1, Section 9. Your position needs an exception or extension, call it what you will, to the concept of causation, which was Collins a kind of market share liability. Risk contribution, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now the question is, does Collins apply to your case? If it applies, you're home free. If it doesn't apply, you're asking this Court to extend it, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And it's the latter, isn't it? Because it's not precisely on all fours.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I said, is Collins on all fours with your case?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, let's look at that. One, we've got temporal differences. We've discussed that, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Two, under DAS, there was what is called in the case a signature injury. That is, if you took it, even if you were in a small percent, this was the result, right? Is there a signature injury here?
Yes, Your Honor. I would make 2 points with regards to that. Right? One is that there is a signature injury. Lead poisoning is a signature injury of
neurological injury. Is that the signature injury? What's the signature injury?
Well, I think that there is a commonly accepted, broadly accepted within the medical profession, constellation of neuropsychological injuries that flow from lead poisoning. But, Your Honor, if I may add, that if you look at Collins critically, right, the adenocarcinoma, we could make the same argument about the removal of Therese Collins' uterus. Is that a signature injury of DES consumption? I mean, there are medical consequences from the injury that flow from the injury that create a whole constellation of situations which we've alleged for Stephen Thomas.
Neurological injury, neuropsychological injury comes from other sources too, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But I would add, Your Honor, that
you're going to have trouble proving it. Even if you get beyond this Court, you may have trouble proving that your client injury was caused by the lead and not something else, like genetics.
I see my time is up, Your Honor, but if I may respond to that precise point. That is an element of proof upon which Stephen Thomas has the burden of proof, not a reason not to apply Collins. The respondents have a defense there. They can argue and present evidence to the jury on that.
Okay. Now, the other difference is that lead pigment was not marketed generically. Is that true?
No, that's wrong.
It was marketed generically.
It was marketed generically.
Cyanide, Atlantic Richfield, DuPont, NL Industries, et cetera. They just called it cyanide.
They had their own name brands, and they sold it to each other. They supplied – these are vertically integrated corporations, with the exception of American Cyanamid for the most part. These were corporations that mined the lead, smelted the lead, put it in up until the advent of mixed paints, pre-mixed paints. They marketed it and sold it as a dry powder in cans that was identical, and they sold it also in a paste. Right? Now, it's interesting. If you look at the record in the FTC case in 1947, NL Industries, when it was trying to defend itself from allegations of collusion and price fixing with regards to products including white lead, argued that white lead was substantially an identical product, that there was substantially no significant variation.
Were there chemical differences from one brand to the other, or are these standard, is this lead pigment a standard defined product?
There are minor formulary variations with regards to how many lead atoms attached to a carbonate atom. Basically, but this is a different.
You have to prove then that one was as bad as the other, regardless of the minor differences.
Yes, Your Honor. I would argue that that's a difference of no substance in this case.
All right. Now, this lead pigment was put into paints, right?
Yes.
By somebody else.
In some instances, but in most instances, it was put into paint by these very defendants.
So they manufactured the component and manufactured the paint.
And they did so with the intent that it be put in paint, knowing that it would be put in paint.
All right.
Go ahead.
So those seem to me some of the major alleged differences between DES and yours. Are there any other alleged differences?
I don't know that there are any alleged differences between DES and lead that go to the policy issues that were being addressed by Collins with regards to the ability to identify the offending manufacturer.
So you just want a shot to get to the fact finder.
I'm sorry, isn't there one other difference between DES and the lead in the sense that DES, at the time of production, they were not aware of the ultimate problems to be found?
That's true. And in this regard, I would think the conduct of these manufacturers was more culpable, more offensive.
It's DES that was not aware.
Collins talks about a possible statistical link. And that's what existed in 1984 when Collins was decided, a possible statistical link. The correlation between lead ingestion in children and lead poisoning and serious problems, health problems for those children, is so much stronger. And was. In 1904, when Sherwin-Williams was selling paint with zinc in it, advertising it as safe, and they talked about the imperative that lead be discontinued in paint. And France had already outlawed it, and Belgium had already outlawed it, and Austria had already outlawed it in 1904. In 1910, they start selling lead paint because they have a factory in Chicago. And they start advertising it as safe for nurseries a few years later.
Counsel, I've got...
Justice Wilcox.
This is an answer, and I know your red light is on, but
yes,
Chief Justice brought up a question to distinguish between people that produced white lead carbonate and some other white lead pigment. In other words, so I understand, do you have any scientific proof that because there is a difference. You said it's very minuscule. In other words, some people put another form of lead, white lead pigment, and not, we're talking here, if I understand what you're coming here on, we're talking about producers of white lead carbonate. And I guess maybe someone else asked the question, all paints weren't made with white, and that was the chief's question. And I'm asking, do you have any scientific, something that you could put your, you know, hang your hat on as far as your client, Thomas, ingested white lead carbonate rather than some other form of white lead pigment that's used in the paint.
Thank you for the question, Justice Wilcox, because it's a very important question. Yes. The defendants assert in their brief, I believe, at page 27 and 28, that we can't prove that Stephen ingested white lead carbonate. That's just flat-out wrong. And they cite the affidavit of Dr. Mushak at the trial court level. What they ignore is the supplemental affidavit of Dr. Mushak at R484 in the record, and the supplemental and the surreply brief at the trial court level at R483. Dr. Mushak, through the magic of electron microscopy, we were able to get a layer-by-layer analysis of the elemental composition of every single layer of paint in the various areas of Stevens houses where the health department had inspected and found hazards. Dr. Mushak was able to examine that layer-by-layer analysis and could determine with empirical certainty, absolutely, that there was no chromium and no sulfate in certain layers that had huge amounts of lead. As a result, you have an absolutely empirical conclusion that it was white lead carbonate, because if it was lead sulfate, there would be sulfur. If it was lead chromate, there would be chromium. The vast majority of lead pigment that was produced for residential use was white lead carbonate.
So your position is there's a genuine issue of material fact.
Right, and it's the first element that Stephen Thomas has the burden of proof at trial before a jury.
And this is a summary judgment case.
And we presented massive evidence in support of that proposition.
Okay, when you come back on rebuttal, I'm going to ask you what other issues of material facts there are that this can't be on summary judgment. Justice Prosser.
I'm interested in exploring the similarities and differences between DES and lead paint. In the Collins case, with the DES, could Dr. Wendt have been a tortfeasor?
I suppose he may have. We submitted with our appendix medical literature showing that there was huge variation in the dosage and longevity of DES exposure by women pursuant to their doctor's prescriptions. Some cases involve very small amounts of DES. In some cases involve massive amounts of DES. Some cases involve DES exposure throughout the pregnancy, and some only during certain parts of the pregnancy. So the Collins case is silent on that, as to whether that was there, and we searched the record high and dry for some indication.
Let me ask, could Walgreens drugstore have been a tortfeasor?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I don't understand the circumstance under which Walgreens would have been a tortfeasor in the DES case unless they marketed and distributed it. I mean, if they're responding to a prescription written by a doctor and it's a FDA-allowed drug, I don't know. If they were and they were on the special jury verdict form, I would think that their counsel would have a case that they could make in their defense.
Now, moving to the lead case, Sears sells lead paint, I presume, lead-based paint.
I don't think anybody sells lead-based paint, Your Honor, for residents.
During the period that we're talking about, are they a potential tortfeasor?
I would think under certain circumstances they could have been. I think that they are, for practical purposes, inaccessible as a defendant in a case such as this. The records from throughout the 8 decades that lead pigment was being sold in paint, subject to being able to trace the sale from that location to a home, I don't think we would be asking, or anybody would be asking, for with regards to a retailer for the kind of particularized causation relaxation we're asking for with regards to the manufacturers of the tortious product.
Well, now when I was growing up, there was a Sherwin-Williams store, and we got the paint from Sherwin-Williams, but, a lot of people went, we didn't normally go to the factory, we went through a retail outlet, and certainly Sears and a lot of other prominent middle organizations were the ones that actually sold the paint. Aren't they potential defendants in your theory?
Well, the question of whether they're potential defendants, the legal issue of whether as a distributor or a retailer they share a liability for the inherently hazardous product that was sold, is a question that I don't think really arises in this case, or in the case of lead-poisoned children today, because those records don't exist. There's no way of knowing what store the paint in Stephen Thomas' two residences came from. There are no receipts. There's no living memory of that. So for practical reasons, the rule, just even from a policy perspective, the probabilities that by bringing in somebody who may have sold lead paint, that person had a tortious involvement relative to the plaintiff is so far stretched. We don't have to contort probability with regards to these defendants.
Are there a limited number of defendants, that is, a limited number of manufacturers of this kind of component?
Yeah, we take some issue with some of the representations of the defendants that there were thousands of manufacturers. I think the FTC case makes clear our affidavit, the affidavit of White's affidavit, which is attached to our supplemental appendix, makes very clear that these defendants represent virtually 100% of the market.
It seems to me, in response to Justice Prosser's question, you are saying that the risk contribution theory or market share theory applies only to manufacturers of a product and not the retail sellers like Walgreens, Sears. And as to the retailers, there you'd have to have evidence of causation, because ordinarily a supplier or a middle supplier, the person who sells to the retailer under strict product liability rule, is liable.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think Your Honor has worded my response more articulately than I was able to. And that's exactly what I think our position is. I think that's correct.
Are there any other questions? Mr. Earle, you may be seated.
At this point, I guess I would introduce Mr.
Mr. McConnell, on the basis of the representations, that you're a lawyer in good standing in Rhode Island, and you are, counsel?
Yes, Judge.
We're admitting you pro hoc vici for 5 minutes. After that.
I'll go quick.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Robert McConnell, on behalf of Stephen Thomas. I want to thank the Court for the honor of being able to appear before it today. I'd like to discuss the elements of Stephen Thomas's conspiracy claim. Stephen has produced an abundance of evidence that should permit him to go forward on his conspiracy claim. The first element of conspiracy is that is the requirement of the formation and operation of a conspiracy. The plaintiff has produced the following evidence on this point. In 1928, the Lead Industries Association was formed. At various times, each of these defendants or their predecessors were members of the LIA while they were actively manufacturing white lead carbonate. For instance, National Lead was a member from 1928 to 1983. Sherwin-Williams was a member of the LIA from 1928 to 1947. Atlantic Richfield, through its predecessors, was a member of the LIA from 1928 to 1971. We actually have a complete list of the membership in the years on at footnote 5 of the brief that we submitted to this Court. The evidence further shows that at the time the LIA was formed in 1928, there was a growing amount of information about the hazards of white lead. By 1920, numerous articles in the medical literature appeared linking lead-based paint to lead poisoning in children. We have an in-depth list of those at Plaintiff's Appendix 130 to 134. Also, prior to the LIA's formation, there's evidence that certain defendants published documents indicating that they had actual knowledge of the hazards of white lead. These defendants include Sherwin-Williams, Glidden, and National Lead. Further, some of these same defendants were also producing non-lead safe alternatives at the time of the formation of the LIA. Plaintiff asserts that the LIA was created to combat the negative publicity about the harmfulness of lead, also to protect the interest of lead whenever, quote, government rules affect the outlet for this product. Plaintiff submits that the LIA was the vehicle in which these defendants carried out the conspiracy. As to the second element of the conspiracy, wrongful acts done pursuant to the conspiracy. From its inception, the LIA was responding to, quote, undesirable publicity regarding lead poisoning. This included rebutting research on lead's toxicity, sponsoring research to show lead was harmless, and refusing to warn the public, even in light of the fact that children were dying, that lead was poisonous. Most importantly, the LIA also underwent promotional campaigns, again, with the backdrop of this growing amount of literature out there about the hazard of lead paint. In 1938, the biggest promotional campaign was launched, and that was the LIA's white lead promotional campaign. It was designed to promote white lead despite the growing information about lead's hazards.
Counsel, one of the problems I have with conspiracy is that some of the references to conspiracy arguably come later than the potential application of the paint here.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. The houses were built in the early 1900s. But as Mr. L. pointed out, the analysis that we have from Dr. Muschak shows there were about 16 layers of paint on the Thomas house, and the majority of them contained lead. So although initially, if the first layer of paint that we had lead, and we knew the houses were built in the 1900s, I think your point might be very well taken. But I think opposition is that the conspiracy went throughout the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and that the houses that Stephen lived in were painted, obviously, throughout that time.
Mr. McConnell, you point at page 37 of your brief that the various elements to be shown to show a civil conspiracy. One of the things that you allude to, and this is what I wanted to ask you about, is additionally, to form a conspiracy, there must be an agreement to violate or disregard the law. How do you overcome that in this case?
Well, Judge, I think, Your Honor, I think that we don't have a written document where the companies agreed to violate the law.
Do you have any disregard of the law at all?
I believe we do. We have, again, when the white lead promotion campaign was launched, we have an abundance of knowledge that lead was hazardous, but what we have the companies doing is, instead of dealing with that issue, instead of maybe holding back, they go out and actively promote lead as safe with knowledge.
Maybe I'm not making my question clear. I guess my question goes to whether or not it was legal to use white lead carbonate up until 1978.
It was, Your Honor.
Then how was the law disregarded?
It was legal to use the product. I think the law was disregarded by the tortious act of negligently producing or promoting lead at the time when they knew or should have known that it was hazardous to children.
So the law is the law of negligence.
Yes.
That is, you shall not produce something that's toxic.
The underlying tort would be negligence and strict liability. I see my time is up.
Other questions? Justice Prosser.
Is there lead poisoning in Providence?
There's a lot of lead poisoning in Providence, Your Honor.
What's the ritziest suburb of Providence?
It's probably a section called the east side of Providence.
Is there any lead poisoning on the east side of Providence?
There is, Your Honor. There's not as much as in the inner city of South Providence, but kids get lead poisoned when more affluent homeowners on the east side renovate their house. Kids get lead poisoned when the more affluent homeowners on the east side have children who go out to the windowsills, just as Mr. Earle, you know, spoke about earlier with kids in Milwaukee, and chew an intact windowsill. Yeah, lead poisoning is a problem. We have, there are articles published, it's not in this record, called Yuppie Lead Poisoning. There's an article by Dr. Michael Chen of Children's Hospital in Boston talking about the rich suburbs of Boston where kids get lead poisoning. It's an inner-city problem, but it's not a problem that's solely relegated to the inner city.
Should the defendants have contemplated people eating paint off the wall?
Well, it's not necessarily eating paint off the wall, Your Honor. I think it's what they should have contemplated was that lead paint applied to the interiors and exteriors of homes would come in contact with children. There's very early evidence that they stopped, or they allegedly stopped, putting lead paint early on toys and cribs in response to children's gnawing. Anyone with a 2-year-old knows, I shouldn't say anyone, but my 2-year-old would put a lot of things in his mouth. Most kids chew things. I mean, it's common knowledge. But to follow that up, it's therefore common knowledge that you can't distinguish between only toys and cribs with children if the windowsill is at this height and a 3-year-old, it's mouth level for a 3-year-old. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kelly, you're going to be introduced by David Peterson. Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices, good afternoon. I am David Peterson of the law firm of Godfrey & Kahn. I'm honored to have the privilege of appearing before you this afternoon, and am pleased to have the opportunity to introduce Mr. Bruce Kelly. Mr. Kelly's from the law firm of Arnold & Porter, and he was admitted pro hac vici in this matter in the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. Mr. Kelly is admitted to practice in the state and federal courts in the state of New York, and is a member in good standing of the New York State Bar. May it please the court, we would request that Mr. Kelly be allowed to present argument here this afternoon on behalf of the respondents in this matter.
Counsel, Mr. Kelly, you too are permitted to practice pro hac vici. You get 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the privilege of being here. The defendant respondents have divided their argument. I will be sharing it with Mr. Muhlenberg. I will address the reasons why the court should not, as a matter of state law, extend Collins to apply this situation. Mr. Muhlenberg will address the federal constitutional issue involved in deciding whether to extend Collins, and will also talk about the issues other than Collins, such as conspiracy. I want to talk about really three things today. I want to explain what I think is the essence of the reasons why the court should not extend Collins in this case. I want to comment on a handful of points that the plaintiff raised for the first time in his reply brief and that we've not previously had a chance to address. And I want briefly, if time permits, to talk just a little bit about the subject of insurance for landlords. The plaintiff is asking this court to do what no state has ever done and what multiple courts have refused to do, namely to apply to lead pigment manufacturers a theory of collective liability that has been devised for DES cases and so far used only in DES cases. Now, the reasons why the court shouldn't do this can really be reduced to two words, fairness and necessity. Let me talk first about what I mean by fairness. Trying this case under the rule of Collins, as the plaintiff requests, would be fundamentally unfair to the defendants to a degree not present in a DES case. Let me explain why. In any tort case, the plaintiff has to prove both a breach of duty by the defendant and that the breach of duty caused harm to the plaintiff. And causation is the nub of the problem here. Causation in a DES case is a relatively straightforward proposition. If the plaintiff has this very rare cancer that is almost uniquely associated with DES and can prove that her mother took DES during the 9-month period while pregnant with the plaintiff, she's established really an overwhelming case on injury and causation. perhaps enough for a directed verdict on those issues. Here we have an altogether different situation. We have, on the one hand, a company, an unidentified company, that manufactured lead pigment. And let me stop right here to point out that although the plaintiff has mentioned that some of these companies also made paint, they are sued here exclusively as pigment manufacturers. We have that company that some number of decades ago, we don't know exactly when, manufactured lead pigment. And on the other hand, we have Stephen Thomas, who claims that in the 1990s he ingested some paint, deteriorated paint, that contained that lead pigment, and that that caused him to have an elevated blood lead level, which in turn led to all of these neuropsychological harms that have been claimed here. In between those two phenomena, we have a whole range of events and actors that cry out for examination. We have a paint manufacturer that either knew or didn't know something about the hazards of using lead pigment in its paint and made a decision that it would purchase lead pigment and incorporate it in a paint for residential use. We have a property owner or a painting contractor who made the decision to take that paint and apply it to the walls. We have generation after generation of succeeding owners who either did or did not maintain the paint appropriately, culminating in the owners who were in possession of the property at the time Stephen Thomas resided there, who by his own allegation negligently failed to maintain the painted surfaces and allowed it to deteriorate so that a child could ingest it.
Well, Mr. Keller, let me ask you about, because I had somewhat trouble by the causation issue. As I understand it, a landlord who fails to maintain the premises so that paint inappropriately breaks down has been held liable when lead has been mixed with the paint that deteriorated. However, if there is no lead in the property that was had failed to be maintained, you're not going to have lead poisoning. Isn't that correct?
That should be correct. So certainly not lead poisoning from paint.
Exactly, at least not from paint. So you really can't have one without the other. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. In every one of these cases, there is a landlord who negligently failed to maintain the property, and certainly that's what we have here. What the court decided in the Antoine A case is essentially, I wouldn't call it a rule of strict liability, but it made one of those cases very, very difficult for the landlord to win, because the court held as a matter of law that a landlord who owns a pre-1978 property cannot claim to be unaware of the hazards of lead paint.
Well, counsel, what difference does it make if you got a whole series of people, manufacturer, property owner, landlord who maintained, rental management who maintained? You can bring them all in if you think they should share the liability.
We don't know who they are. And the
you can find out the owners by the Register of Deeds. You just look and see. You can track all the owners.
They're all dead in most cases. And you certainly can't find out.
And that's a problem in a lot of cases. People die. You can't get them. The estates are closed.
That is certainly true, Your Honor. The question here is whether we should be expanding and modifying the common law of Wisconsin to accommodate a case of this kind where all the relevant evidence on causation is going to be inaccessible.
I'm sorry. Finish answering your question.
I wanted to hear your question, actually, Your Honor, because I was about to launch into another point.
Well, it kind of comes to the second part of my question where I was trying to go with this. It goes to the concept of breach of duty. Because, as you outlined, that's one of the elements we have to look at here. How long did the lead pigment manufacturers know of the problem with lead and its ingestion by young people? How long has that been known for?
That would be disputed at trial. The plaintiff's experts have conceded that, in their view, it was appropriate to continue marketing lead pigment and lead paint into the 1920s. We actually believe it was appropriate for a good deal longer than that.
There's also literature showing that goes back to, 1904, is it?
It depends on what the problem is you're talking about, Your Honor. The kinds of subtle neuropsychological harms that are attributed to lead ingestion by the plaintiff's experts in a case like this
on the subject of medical research that's only occurred since the 1970s. Everybody's known for many, many years that very severe doses of lead can be harmful or even fatal. But no one has known until very recently that asymptomatic children who do not appear to have anything wrong with them may have elevated blood lead levels that are associated with neuropsychological harms. In fact, and this is to some degree outside the record, but average blood lead levels in the population as a whole have gone way down in recent years and were much higher in the years past. When Justice Wilcox was a child, in addition to biting on the fishing sinkers, there was also lead in gasoline. And it came out the tailpipe of every car in the United States. And as a result, blood lead levels, on average, were much higher then than they are now.
Counsel, then that's an issue of material fact.
The issue of material fact...
Your defendants knew or should have known that there was danger. Right?
No question that would have been an issue for trial. The issue on which summary judgment was granted here was causation, right, not negligence or state-of-the-art of the defendant's knowledge.
I'm interested in following up the comment that Mr. McConnell made. In posing the question about poor areas where landlords permitted paint to deteriorate, that is probably going to be true in ritzy suburbs of Providence or ritzy suburbs of Milwaukee or Madison. Shouldn't one have contemplated that there would be some children that would actually gnaw on wood painted with lead paint?
I don't think so, Your Honor. If you look at cases, if you look at this case and cases like this generally, sure, in theory, a child could ingest paint anywhere, but if you want to look in the real world where the cases come from, they come from severely deteriorated inner-city houses where the landlords have neglected the painted surfaces. They do not come from the ritzy suburbs. Just the other day, I looked on the website of the Wisconsin State Department of Public Health, and they published statistics about children with elevated blood lead levels. The majority of those children are identified as being Medicaid recipients. Those are not the kids from the ritzy suburbs. I want to refocus on the fairness issue that I was on and talk about trial, because that is really a really important issue to us. Let's just imagine for a moment that Stephen Thomas could identify who the pigment manufacturer was of the pigment that he identified. Collins is at that point inapplicable. You would then have a trial at which that manufacturer would point out all of the intervening events between its act of manufacturing and selling lead pigment and the harm that has been claimed in this case. Of course, we're not going to have that kind of trial. If you have a trial under the rule of Collins, you have a trial in which the court has placed, not deliberately, but as a matter of reality, an enormous thumb on the scales in the determination of causation. The jury in such a trial is going to understand that some court, either the trial court or this court, has determined that the role of the pigment manufacturer must be of paramount significance relative to the role of the paint manufacturer and all the people who are involved in paint.
I don't understand that.
Because the jury will be confronted by a set of defendants who are all trying to prove they're not the pigment manufacturer, and it will be told that the plaintiff does not have the burden of proving who is the pigment manufacturer.
Well, why can't they defend on the ground of intervening causes, just like if there was one defendant? That defendant could defend on the basis that others were involved. It seems to me all the defendants here can say, sure, we made it, but A, B, C, D, E, F, G were also involved, and you can even get a jury verdict about comparative negligence.
They can say it, Your Honor, but the jury is going to say to itself, if the actual those arguments about intervening causation are designed to show that the actual manufacturer, whoever it was, is not at fault.
Due to all the manufacturers. I don't see why you can't say none of these manufacturers should be held liable because you had all these intervening causes.
I believe
that the property had been maintained properly, you wouldn't be liable.
I think the jury is going to draw the conclusion that if all these manufacturers are trying so hard to prove that they were not the actual manufacturer by presenting the kind of evidence that Collins asks for about exculpation or allocating the likelihood that particular defendants were the actual manufacturer, the jury is going to be heavily tilted toward finding that the actual manufacturer is at fault and disregarding the causal role played by all the intervening factors.
Can we untilt the jury by an instruction that's appropriate for this kind of case?
I'm not sure that will be an instruction comparable to the proverbial asking the jury not to think about a pink elephant. I think it would be very difficult to undo that kind of unfairness. And it's a level of unfairness that, as I said before, exists in this case but not a DES case because of the intervening causation issues. I want to talk a little bit before...
Ms. Muhlenberg, you talk about fairness, and I go back and looking at the 1904 Sherwin-Williams report in the SWP that SCM Chemicals report in 24, the National Lead Company 1912 report. Isn't one big difference between this case and the DES case the fact that the lead pigment carbonate manufacturers were aware that there was a potential hazard here as opposed to in DES they were not aware?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, that we can assume that in DES they were not aware, or let me put it differently. I think the plaintiff in the DES case has some burden of demonstrating that the manufacturers knew or should have known of the hazards of DES and failed to warn of those hazards. That's the whole theory of a DES case, that the manufacturer failed to warn the medical profession of the hazards of ingesting DES during pregnancy. One member of the court asked whether the doctor in the DES case could be liable. I don't think he could because on the facts as they were presented to the court, there was no reason a member of the medical profession should have known of the hazard that eventuated when people took DES during pregnancy. But I think the plaintiff would have had the burden of proving that the manufacturer knew or should have known, an issue that really wasn't addressed in Collins.
Well, if this court should find causation, that is to extend the risk contribution theory, would you go back and then have a summary judgment on the negligence issue? I mean, you agreed that the issue upon which you won was causation.
That's correct.
Not negligence. Do you agree that if you lose on causation, it would go back for trial and then it would then be a determination of negligence?
We would certainly have to review the record and make a motion for summary judgment on the issue of negligence.
So the issue of negligence is really not before us.
Absolutely. And it wasn't before Judge Dugan either.
Just causation.
That's correct. The second point I wanted to talk about is necessity. I think if you read Collins, it comes through loud and clear that the court felt that it was necessary to modify the common law in order to provide Therese Collins with a remedy because otherwise she would lack one. This case is 180 degrees different. There is a remedy available against an identified tortfeasor, the tortfeasor who is made liable by this court's decision in Antoine A. And it is a particularly...
Mr. Kelly, let me interrupt you right there. Don't we have to look at the Peace decision also when we start talking about necessity here?
That gets to my point about insurance, which I will cover right now. When the court decided Peace, it wasn't holding that landlords may not insure against this particular risk. It was holding that a particular contract of insurance did not insure against this particular risk. And there were some members of the court who expressed concern that this was creating a big problem in this kind of case because landlords would be without insurance and children would go uncompensated. If that has developed as a problem, this case doesn't show it. In this case, we had two landlords and they were both covered by insurance. Interestingly, the insurance policy that was issued at issue in Peace
was a result of a revision to the standard form that had taken place in 1985, and the exposure in Peace had been, I think, between 1987 and 1990. This case is nearly contemporaneous. It's a little more recent. We have exposure between 1990 and 1993, but these landlords insurers, at least, have not gotten around to adopting the form that was at issue in Peace. More broadly, if there is a problem, I respectfully suggest that it is the kind of problem that is far more suitable for investigation by the legislature than by this court in a case like this. The legislature can look at the big picture, can ask the insurance companies, are you writing this kind of insurance? And if not, why not? It can identify whatever market imperfections are causing the insurance not to be written, if that's the case. And it can figure out what combination of regulatory carrots and sticks ought to be applied to landlords and insurance carriers to make sure that an appropriate result ensues. Regulating the business of insurance is obviously something the legislature does as its regular exercise.
As Peace was decided in 1999, what has happened with regard to those efforts which you suggest could be made thus far?
The only thing that we're aware of is that the legislature adopted a provision which is cited in our brief that provides that where a landlord goes and gets a certificate of lead-safe or lead-free status, which means he's got to have his property inspected to determine that, the landlord can achieve immunity from liability, which is certainly a way of doing something that I think is the most desirable result. And getting back to the issue of fairness and litigating these cases against the appropriate defendant.
That goes to prospective cases. But what about the existing cases? How does that address what it was argued was the vacuum left by the combination of Antoine and Peace, and that you assert that it should be left to the legislature to divine?
All I can say about that, Your Honor, is that if there is such a vacuum, the record in this case doesn't show it to exist.
Your opposing counsel, colleagues have brought up Peace. Your opposing counsel indicates that landlords do not have insurance for lead paint claims, and you're indicating that that is not valid.
Opposing counsel says that without citation to the record. I have no idea whether it's valid or not. The record in this case will not tell us whether it's valid.
And the only thing your comeback is that, at least in two landlords involved out of the three here had insurance.
That's correct. If it were really true that the adoption of the form of policy that was at issue in Peace was going to cause all landlords to go uncovered for all time, these landlords wouldn't have been covered either. That's the one thing that the record in this case does tell us.
But he talks about sound economic policy in sharing the risk, and that's the issue. In Peace, which there was a very well-written dissent, which talked about the very thing. I'm talking about that there would not be insurance, that they could not obtain insurance, and that's an issue that I'm kind of unclear on.
As I said, the only answer I can give to that is that if that's a problem, the record in this case doesn't show it to be a problem. One further thing I can say, which goes to the issue of necessity, and I see that my time is up, but this, I think, sums up very aptly the essence of the defendant's argument here. Out of the whole range of people over this long span of time who might be said to bear some causal responsibility for a child's ingestion of lead paint, the landlord, who is made liable under Antoine A, is the one person who is in a position to do something today to stop that from happening in future cases. The law of Wisconsin today makes landlords liable and gives them a very powerful incentive to maintain their properties and make sure cases of this kind do not occur. And that, I submit, is where the law of Wisconsin should be left. And we should not be changing the common law of Wisconsin to involve a whole different set of defendants for this kind of case.
So I gather your position is a landlord should bear all liability for lead paint poisoning.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll now yield to Mr. Muhlenberg.
Okay, we're just going to take a couple of minutes, Mr. Daly, so that Marshal can change the disc for recording these oral arguments. Just give us 1 minute. Mr. Daly, Attorney Daly.
May it please the Court, as always, it's an honor to appear before you, and I do that today to introduce to you, from the great state of Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, my co-counsel, Charles H. Muhlenberg, a member of the Bar of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, a member in good standing, admitted to its courts, my co-counsel in this matter, and after following Lawyer Kelly to the rostrum, it was deemed to be fundamentally unfair to have two Irishmen arguing for the appellees. At that, I introduce Mr. Muhlenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Daly. Mr. Muhlenberg, you're admitted pro hoc vici for 10 minutes. Well, there
are. Thank you very much, Madam Chief Justice, Honorable Justices. It's a pleasure and a privilege to appear before you this afternoon. I want to begin by talking about the very important constitutional principles at stake here. These principles draw not only from the federal Constitution, but just as importantly, more importantly, from the Wisconsin Constitution, all of which guarantee all parties in litigation the right to due process. 8 years ago, the Supreme Court of my home Commonwealth of Pennsylvania had a very similar case. Case of market share liability and whether market share liability should be extended to former manufacturers of white lead pigments. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania in that case said that there was a vitally important link provided by the causation standard. It decided not to extend market share liability, not to adopt market share liability, because, and I quote, application of market share liability to lead paint cases, such as this one, would lead to a distortion of liability, which would be so gross as to make determinations of culpability arbitrary and unfair. That was a unanimous opinion written by Justice Cappy. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court does not stand alone. The Federal Circuit Courts for the First Circuit, an opinion written by now U.S. Supreme Court Justice Breyer, the Third Circuit and the Fifth Circuit have all said the same. There are basic principles of fairness and due process that underlie the tort law principles, the principles of strict liability. And the very first principle at stake here, I would suggest, is that manufacturers should be held liable only for harm that they cause. And in this case, based on this record, it's not a question of which of these companies may have caused any harm to this plaintiff. It's a question of whether any of them caused any harm to this plaintiff.
Mr. Muhlenberg, how is market share liability different from the risk contribution theory or approach?
It's a difficult question to answer, Justice Crooks, because there is no single theory of market share liability. Every state Supreme Court that has looked at this issue has come up with a different variation. I believe the main difference is that under risk contribution theory, the plaintiff can identify and name just one defendant. And that one defendant is held jointly severally liable for 100% of the liability unless that defendant in some way can start to spread the risk to others. That's not the case typically with market share liability, where you have to show that a substantial share of the market is in front of the court and the defendant is only held liable for its percentage share of that market. So it suggests that the risk contribution theory in Collins is a more extreme theory in imposing burdens on a defendant manufacturer than a market share liability theory adopted in some other states.
If that's true, then all this discussion about other people being liable, seller, landlord, doesn't matter in risk contribution theory. It's your job to prove that you're not going to be 100% liable.
Well, I believe it does matter if you look at Collins and the way it sets up the various risk factors that can be considered. It would allow a defendant to try to mitigate the amount of risk it contributed into the market by showing that others had participated.
But you don't get a summary judgment. You can mitigate at trial.
Oh, that's true, Your Honor, but the one fact that is undisputed on this record that is dispositive is, and the plaintiffs have admitted it from the very beginning in their complaint, is they cannot identify who made the white lead carbonate. In addition, they don't know when it was put on. And what we have here is a strange situation where the plaintiffs are trying to mix and match. You know, they talk about, say, the 1939 white lead promotion campaign of the Lead Industries Association. The paint could have been put on in 1900, or 1905, well before that campaign took place.
When was this house constructed, or these two houses?
The two, one was built in 1900, the other in 1905. The plaintiff's own experts, in this case, admit that these defendants should not be considered culpable until the mid-1920s. And that's because there were not viable alternatives. We all, I think, understand that lead is ubiquitous. It was used in many products, still is used in many products today. It's one of the most useful metals around. Lead was used in paints going back for thousands of years. A very useful product. The plaintiff's experts understand that. They say that by the mid-1920s, there still wasn't enough awareness of the risk to make it fair to say that these companies should have taken white lead carbonate off the market. So we.
When do you think there was enough knowledge of the risk to make it fair?
Our experts would say, Your Honor, in the early 1950s for interior residential paint. At that point in time, when the information came out of the city of Baltimore that there was an unexplained uptick in the incidence of childhood lead poisoning, the health commissioner of Baltimore went in to investigate and found out for the first time that there were large numbers of homes with massive amounts of peeling paint. I mean, they had photographs of paint from the ceiling touching the floor. It was so bad in some of the old row houses in Baltimore. At that point, the industry stepped in, worked with the public health officials, the health commissioner in Baltimore. There was an ordinance in Baltimore put into place by 1951. There was an industry standard in place by 1955 for interior residential paint. Nobody at that point in time was concerned yet about exterior paint. The first time that exterior lead paint was regulated was in 1971 when the federal government stepped in with a ban on all interior residential
paint. Your response seems to point to an incident when it was discovered a large amount of chipping paint. But it seems to me eminently foreseeable for anyone who's done interior painting to know that the paint is going to chip. And so do you need this large demonstration in the 50s to know that? I mean, as soon as you know that the lead can be harmful, and you know that, at least at my home, inherent in interior painting is chipping,
Doesn't that blend give you a foreseeability?
I think, Your Honor, that's going to be the standard. And let me say that the toxicity of lead was well known going back to Greek times, as this court recognized in peace. Lead is still being used in many, many products today. There's more lead being made and put into products today than ever because it's such a useful product. The question is, how is it used? How is it maintained? And that's why I based my answer on the 1950s, because up until then, it was now realized that there would be these large numbers of property owners, landowners, that they would ignore the responsibilities, ignore both their common law responsibilities and later, as statutory responsibilities kicked in, would ignore those as well and not maintain the product. If that's going to be the standard, that you cannot put anything with any risk into a product that's going into a home, I would suggest you'd have very little in your home. It would be bare. I mean, we couldn't have light bulbs. We couldn't have bleach. We couldn't have drain cleaners because all of those products bear risks. The question is, how do you manage that risk? And in this situation, it's always been the responsibility of the property owners. And that's why we've said it's the property owners that create the risk in the first place. It's fair to put the responsibility on them. And the legislature has, by saying that intact lead paint is not a hazard. It does not have to be removed today. But the property owners, and that's the legislative scheme accepted by public health officials in this state and in Milwaukee as well.
Counsel, did all the defendants manufacture this component in 1900?
No, Your Honor.
Which ones didn't?
My client, the Sherwin-Williams Company, did not. American Cyanamid's predecessor company did not. I do not believe that Atlantic Richfield's predecessor manufactured at that point. The predecessor to the to Millennium, which is the Glidden Company, did not manufacture. And at the other end, there were a number of companies that left the market. Sherwin-Williams, for example, stopped manufacturing in 1947. The predecessor to Atlantic Richfield stopped manufacturing in 1946. That's why I say we have this real problem of mixing and matching in this situation. Nothing is tethered together in a way that would make a fair trial. It's adding these types of irrebuttable presumptions that we would say would be a violation of due process in addition to imposing severely retroactive responsibility on these companies.
DuPont manufacture in 1900?
DuPont? I do not believe so, Your Honor.
Did any of these?
I believe that the National Lead Company did.
Are these cases being brought in any state with a statute of repose for product liability?
We have not, I believe, run across that issue in any individual personal injury case. We have argued statute of limitations, and I believe a statute of repose issue when a case has been brought by a property owner or a public entity. But we have not faced that with respect to an individual. And that's because the individuals are children and the statute of limitations is not going to run against a child. Okay, so my time has expired. I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Mullenberg. Mr. Earle, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Stand in front of the microphone so we can take.
There are a number of points I would like to make. First, the defendants make much of the idea that all responsibility should be placed on the landlords. They point to the Antoine A. case, and they point to the legislation enacted by the state of Wisconsin. The fact is, the legislation in the state of Wisconsin has a savings clause in it that specifically says nothing in this subchapter may be interpreted or applied in any manner to impair the right of any person, entity, municipality, or other political subdivision to sue for damages or equitable relief. So while the state legislature was constructing the statutory scheme, imposing
remedial obligations on the landlords with regards to proper maintenance, they were saving whatever causes of action existed at that point in time. This is clear. Second, with regards to summary judgment, with regards to the pollution exclusion and the availability of insurance, I think it's instructive to note that in this very case, and the record is at R-148, Judge Patricia McMahon entered summary judgment in favor of State Farm Insurance under pursuant to the pollution exclusion clause and that insurance policy that applied to the Henke property. As a result, the plaintiff abandoned those claims. Second, the question here of 8 decades and the large amount of time that transpired between the time lead paint was applied and the time that Stephen Thomas was injured. We have to look at this case. In this case, the sites where the hazards existed, where Stephen was probably poisoned, contained one of the places, for example, 18 layers of paint. 16 of those 18 had lead pigment in them. Of those 16, the only ones that didn't were the top layer and the middle layer, the eighth layer. This is clear evidence that lead was applied over and over and over and over again to the property, implying that there was a reasonable basis to believe that multiple respondents participated.
Was that your position, that anyone that manufactured in that time period from 1900 on can be a defendant?
Yes, if they are identifiable and they are suable. In other words, if they're amenable to process, if not in bankruptcy, if they exist, and that's absolutely true. The Collins case rejected alternative liability because it was concerned as a policy matter about making sure there was a fair method of allocating liability amongst a group of defendants, all of whom breached the duty. And that's why the court identified 7 factors, all of which are available to these defendants. Did they issue warnings? What was their market share? Did they lead in the creation of the market? What did they do after they learned it was hazardous? These are factors that go directly to anticipated risk. Now, my opposing counsel said, Your Honor,
go ahead.
My opposing counsel said that there was a gross injustice. It was unfair for making them pay for the harm that someone else did in case they didn't commit the harm themselves. We know that some of them did. Right? We know they all produced the product. We just don't know which one produced the exact product that poisoned the child at a given point in time. Right? And, I would respond to that at several layers, starting with the easiest. This is not a concept that's alien to Wisconsin tort law. It's the very premise of joint and several liability. Negligent parties are often made to pay for the harm caused by other negligent parties. Before 1995, a party with 1% liability could be made to pay for the harm of 100% of the tort that was caused, where somebody else they only did 1%. And that's number one. Number two, these defendants anticipated this risk. They knew. Sherwin-Williams in 1904 called it imperative that lead pigment be discontinued because it was hazardous to the inhabitants of the homes. They knew this. This is not something they didn't understand. Now, Your Honor asked me, before I ended, to identify the areas where there were material issues of disputed fact with regards to the elements of the claims. And I would suggest that there's a dispute about whether there would be a dispute at trial about whether Stephen Thomas ingested white lead carbonate. We established that earlier. Okay. There would be a dispute about whether white lead carbonate, or indeed lead poisoning, caused the injuries Stephen Thomas is asserting. They will no doubt argue that there was genetics involved, that there were environmental issues other than lead that led to the harm that he's asserting. These are issues for a jury. They get to mount evidence and defend themselves. They are not as naked as they make it out to be. The second the other, Your Honor has established that in fact there is a factual dispute about whether they breached a duty. And when they breached the duty, if they breached the duty. You know, the only thing there's not a dispute about is that they manufactured white lead carbonate, they marketed it, and they sold it, and that Stephen Thomas was lead poisoned. Right? Everything else is an issue of fact. And this Court, in creating the Collins model, made sure that there were defenses available to them. And to the extent that there are defenses not available to them in pursuant to the Collins model, it is the result of their tortious conduct, not the construction of the Collins model.
Mr. Earle, could I ask?
I see my time.
When the Collins case was decided, the present language in 895.045 was not in the law, contributory negligence.
That's correct.
51%, the percentage below. Let's just hypothetically take SCM Chemicals, Inc. How would you establish how much they owed?
Well, I would think that SCM, Inc. would attempt to establish what its market share was, would attempt to establish to the jury what it did, or its predecessor corporation did, to mitigate the harm, what it did to educate the public, what it did to establish warnings, and what it did once it learned that lead poisoning was hazardous. Some of these defendants stopped using lead pigment after certain various points in time for various reasons. They can present that to a jury.
So that would be the eighth layer. In other words, you said two layers didn't have white lead carbonate. It was the last layer and the eighth layer. So how would one establish that they were, the paint was on the eighth layer?
I think, for example, Sherwin-Williams has said that they stopped producing lead in a particular year. And I think we could establish in a hypothetical case, Your Honor, for example, if the house, let's take hypothetically a house that was built in 1948. Let's say a child was poisoned in that house. I think Sherwin-Williams would be off the hook. They would be able to establish a defense. The Collins case, with regards to this issue, identified two major factors. One was the producing it during the period of a mother's pregnancy, the DES, and the other was the geographic market. And that's a whole area we haven't talked about. This record contains millions upon millions, not millions, but many, many documents involving sales of receipts of sales, distribution agreements, marketing plans. These defendants have available to them to prove, if the facts warrant it, that they did not distribute lead in Wisconsin. It seems to me that each of these factors goes to tribal issues of fact related to culpability. And they are seeking immunization from culpability.
Thank you, Mr. Earle. Any further questions? If not, that concludes our hearing in 03-1528, Stephen Thompson versus Millett, in a very interesting discussion of Collins and the risk contribution theory. So the court is complete now. We are in recess until 1:30 when we hear the third case for today. And if the students remain here, Justice Bradley will be out in seconds if she doesn't decide to stay and talk about the case to the students. Everybody else is invited to stay, by the way. The discussion will be about the procedure of the court, not the substance of the case. But you're all invited. You're all invited.